605-6646.
This is WGTDHD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Guida Brown, former executive director of the Hope Council, Dr. Steve Brown, retired professor of educational leadership and school law, Dr. Karen Sconsert, chair of the education department and associate professor at Carthage College, Dr. Jonathan Shaler, professor of communications at UW Parkside, and Stephanie Skilba, vice president for community and government relations at Gateway Technical College. And now, here's today's moderator for Education Matters.
And a very pleasant good morning, and welcome to this edition of Education Matters here on WGTDHD. I'm your host today, Steve Brown. We have two segments, and these are rebroadcasts from interviews that I have done in the past. My first guest is Molly McCloskey, and she is with the First Amendment Schools Project in Washington, D.C. And in segment two, my guest is Dr. Matthew Ladner, who is with the Goldwater Institute in Phoenix, Arizona. The most basic liberties guaranteed to Americans, embodied in the 45 words of the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, assure Americans a government that is responsible to its citizens and responsive to their wishes. These 45 words are as alive and important today as they were over 200 years ago. My guest this morning is Molly McCloskey, who is project director for the First Amendment Schools Project based out of Washington, D.C. Molly, welcome to WGTD and Education Matters.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you for having me.
Molly, first of all, you've been involved with the project since it began, I believe. If you can maybe just give some background with respect to how the First Amendment School started, which organizations are involved in it, and just how widespread the project is at this point.
Absolutely. We began First Amendment Schools in the early spring of 2001. At that point, it was a partnership between ASCD, the Association for Supervision Curriculum Development, and the First Amendment Center. Two key leaders in both of those associations, Diane Barris here at ASCD and Charles Haynes at the First Amendment Center, had done a lot of work together on issues around character education and specifically on religious freedom in schools. And the more they talked, the more they really understood that schools traditionally are not terribly democratic places. And if we wanted to prepare children to participate actively in a democracy, we needed to give them practice in the safest places we knew, the places that are in fact designed to give them practice in all of the skills they will need as adults. And so Diane and Charles and Sam Chaltain came together at that time to design First Amendment Schools as a bit of an experiment. We started by asking schools to become laboratories of democracy. We weren't sure exactly what it would look like, but we wanted them to essentially study themselves as they gave young people democratic opportunities. Over those 7 years, we've had 22 schools which received some grant funding to help them in the initiative. We've had another 100 schools across the country in almost all 50 states that wanted to share in the resources, wanted to share in the conversations, and wanted to share in the experience of asking young people not to postpone citizenship until 18, but to realize that they are full members of the community right now.
Mm-hmm. Now, I find it fascinating, the groups that are involved in this. I have been a past member of ASCD, and I'm certainly well aware of the work that it does. And also, I've worked with Charles Haynes several times in the past in teaching school law. Charles has been a guest in my classroom. When I look through the list of the guiding principles of a First Amendment school, and I'll just quickly list them: democratic freedom, rights and responsibilities, community engagement, and active citizenship. I find it fascinating, and as I think back, Molly, when I took government, and I've taught government, and I taught AP government when I was a high school teacher, but I remember back as a student taking a course that was called civics, and I don't know if you took civics, if it was called civics back when you were in junior high or
high. It was called government.
Okay. Well, it was government in high school, but for me in junior high, it was called civics in Florida. But why is it? I mean, what's your feeling in terms of why we have moved away over the years, and not just in the past couple of years, but just over maybe several decades, of why we have moved away from the whole concept of teaching civics to kids with respect to these guiding principles that I just mentioned?
I think that's a really interesting question. As an education association, we know historically that what works in teaching and learning is when young people have opportunities for choice and for voice. When you engage kids and give them chances to make choices in their life and understand that their opinions are heard and valued, they succeed overall. We know that, and yet we don't always do it. And often we don't do it in the name of a false sense of safety. We become afraid that when young people have too much choice, have too much voice, that they will somehow abuse it and not balance between their rights and their responsibilities. And quite frankly, I think we do the same as a country. We have stepped away from the town square as a place of civil discourse and moved into a time where Jerry Springer represents our town square. Mm-hmm. And the loudest name-calling is the democracy of the time. There are all sorts of social factors that go into that. There are certainly the pendulum swings in how we understand our own freedoms. But that's really been a cultural shift. We know that a strong percentage of people in this country actually believe that the First Amendment goes too far mm-hmm. in granting freedoms.
Well, you know, and that's an interesting point. I believe the First Amendment Center puts out a report every year. It's called The State of the First Amendment. And
right.
it's an incredible report. I always have my graduate students read it. And I read it, excuse the expression, religiously every year.
You do, in fact, have that freedom.
You're right, I do. That I find it fascinating that many people, first of all, don't even really know what's included in the First Amendment, and we're going to talk about that in a moment and actually go through what those 5 points are. But I find it fascinating that in your vision statement, you very specifically say, at a time in our history when we most need to reaffirm what we share as citizens across our differences, the ignorance and contention now surrounding the First Amendment threaten to divide the nation and undermine our freedom. And I read that, and I've read it before, but in preparation for this interview today, when I read it again, it just jumped out at me that there is this ignorance, if you will, with respect to what the First Amendment is all about. And it certainly is not coincidental that it's the first of the amendments to the U.S. Constitution.
Absolutely, and that the Founding Fathers missed the opportunity to put it in initially and then realized almost immediately that it was so critical. It had to be named. It couldn't be assumed. And yet, while our Constitution and our beliefs as Americans is that all people are born with these freedoms, none of us are born with the skill and the understanding to exercise them with responsibility. And as we shift out of teaching civics and civic virtue, civic understanding, and really global understanding in our schools, we run the risk that we'll continue to misunderstand the freedom of speech, for instance, as meaning you can say anything you want, as opposed to the capacity and the gift to say what you must. The First Amendment was really put in place by the Founding Fathers because they recognized that these specific actions by the government were what caused war, what caused great conflict over opinions, over conscience, over religion, over questions of the government. And so they laid these freedoms out, and yet, even at that time, we couldn't quite live up to them as a country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we're still working on that.
Of course, and I thought it was such a nice touch that the First Amendment Schools Project was launched on March 16th of 2001, which just coincidentally was the anniversary of James Madison's birth. And I'm sure that was not a coincidence, right?
It was not.
Okay.
It was not. And yet many people would suggest when we say we launched in 2001, frequently we get the question about whether we were a response to September 11th.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There's sort of an automatic feeling that this is a part of some patriotic urge that almost redefines patriotism in a way we're really not discussing here.
Mm-hmm. Before we actually talk about what a school that actually becomes a project school, and I know you have several levels. Before a school becomes a project school, I think it's an affiliate, right? Isn't that the category?
Correct.
But
an affiliate is a different way of
right,
joining
sure.
the project. Yes.
But if you look at the First Amendment. And I always have my students read it, and they're always fascinated by the fact that they always miss one of the 5 points within it. When I've talked with Charles Haynes, and when he was a guest in my class, we talked very specifically about religion. We talked about all the aspects of the First Amendment, but with respect to religion, it says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And those are two very distinctly different concepts, aren't they?
They absolutely are. And in fact, they're often divided both in court cases and in common educational practices to talk about the establishment clause and the free exercise clause.
Now, in putting the project together, when you look at the 5 areas within the First Amendment, certainly anything that deals with religion is going to be the most controversial, the most delicate to deal with, and something that everyone is going to have an opinion on. My question for you, Molly, is how do you make it apolitical? How do you keep it nonpartisan? How do you keep the focus on the Constitution and what our founding fathers were looking for when this was put into the Constitution?
We exercise another aspect of those 45 words, and that's free speech. The real tool in helping schools understand both the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause is talk. We have to engage people in conversation about what it actually means to establish religion in a state setting. Because remember, the First Amendment initially didn't apply to schools or even to the states. It wasn't until the 14th Amendment that it got applied in that way. And so we have a long history of public education that was hardly free from established religion.
Mm-hmm.
That history is deeply ingrained, and we have to get people to talk about what does it look like, what does it mean, and it's hard. This is values-driven. Many people can understand that prayer in classrooms, for instance, although controversial, is generally accepted as being against the First Amendment. It is much harder for schools when they start looking at, for instance, student clubs, and the Wiccans want to form a student club. Or we talk about student-led prayer at a graduation ceremony.
Right.
Those are deeply held values, and it takes a lot of conversation.
Now, within the body of the lesson plans that are provided, kind of a starting point for each of the areas that are provided to the schools, and I think we should say as we're talking about this that the span of grades, are we just talking about high school, or are we talking about at the K-12 level that the overall focus is aimed?
Oh, absolutely. We are talking at the K-12 level.
Okay.
We have schools in every section of the country with every grade configuration you can imagine and in every size and demographic. We wanted to demonstrate that these ideas work in very large urban schools and that they work equally well in small rural schools with a homogeneous population, for instance. It's part of the reason we chose not to dictate a curriculum or a specific instructional technique, that we really wanted guiding principles that each school could then take and say, okay, what does this mean here? How does this apply to our community? And how can we raise the issues, look at the challenges, speak bravely on the issues that confront us?
The first of the guiding principles that you have is to create the laboratories of democratic freedom that you mentioned before. Are members of the community involved? Are parents involved?
It's really been fascinating, and that's been one of the areas where we've seen some real personalization. For instance, one of our early schools, Fairview Elementary School in Modesto, California, is a majority non-native English-speaking school. Many of the parents are migrant workers who have not been traditionally involved in school-based decision-making. They're, for a lot of reasons, uncomfortable occasionally interacting with the school. And when we went in as a First Amendment school, and when they saw the school staff, there was actually sort of a seminal moment when the principal put up a sign about the five freedoms that proved to be a tipping point for that group of parents, and they began advocating for a perimeter fence around the building, that all other elementary schools in the district had perimeter fences for safety, but for some reason Fairview didn't, even though it's on a fairly high-trafficked road. And this group of parents felt empowered to go to the Board of Education and to lobby in their native language to protect their children. The change that created in the school by bringing real voice to those parents is extraordinary. Their academic achievement has improved. Their attendance has improved. The students' participation in extracurricular activities increased. And the working relationships between English-speaking parents and non-native English-speaking parents led to much greater cohesiveness in setting goals for the school community as a whole. It was really incredibly powerful.
With respect to the schools that are in place now, they, as you said, there's these guiding principles. But if there's a school, if there's someone who's listening to our show now, and by the way, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with Molly McCloskey, who is project director for the First Amendment Schools, which is a joint project of the Association for Supervision and Curriculum Development, and then also the First Amendment Center, both in the Washington, D.C. area. But if there's a school that wants to get involved, and I know I was going to talk about this at the end, what is the process? I mean, maybe if you could just talk us through kind of a quick look at the process that a school would go through if they're interested, and maybe what's involved and to what level the school and the community gets involved in that planning.
Sure. Originally, when we initiated the project, we were issuing grants to to a select number of schools. We went through a an application process and selected over time 22 schools that each received some funding over a three-year period. We're no longer actually doing grant funding. We believe that the most effective strategies that our schools used in bringing these principles to life were actually non-funded. It was about the conversations that took place at professional development. It was about working with young people through existing curriculum to help them understand rights and responsibilities and the balance between that. And so we're no longer directly funding schools. However, the FirstAmendmentSchools.org website is a place where schools who are interested in these ideas can come together and talk. There are lesson plans up there. The vision statement is up there. There's profiles of a number of schools who've been involved in the process. There's information. There's links out to other organizations that provide terrific tools for schools to use, whether they're curricular or instructional. Many of them are free. And so all of that is available up on the First Amendment Schools website. I'd also refer people to ASCD's website, wholechildeducation.org. A lot of ASCD's work is based in a call to action for policymakers, educators, community members to work together to ensure that all children are healthy, safe, engaged, supported, and challenged. We believe that our stance on the whole child was really directly informed by our First Amendment schools and what it means to be civically healthy. What does it mean to be engaged in real, meaningful decision-making? What does it mean to have differences, whether they be religious or cultural, ethnic, on any strand, to have them truly supported in a school setting? And what does it mean to have each child in a school be challenged to think critically, which is inherent in First Amendment concepts?
Mm-hmm. I know there was one high school in the Milwaukee area that's been involved in the project. Maybe you could just talk briefly about their project. I do plan to contact the superintendent and the principal. You had given me some information, but maybe you could just talk briefly so we can maybe get more of a local flavor.
Well, and I have to say it's Greendale High School and Greendale School District in the Milwaukee area have not been directly involved with First Amendment schools per se, but there are a number of projects around the country that are looking at setting up really democratic places for young people to go, giving young people the experience in making decisions, giving them that feeling of empowerment and the choice and voice I'm talking about. Greendale is a leader in this field and has been involved in a number of national conferences, a number of national panels. And for instance, if you go right on the homepage of Greendale High School's website, it talks about a student publication and how that publication is itself a manifestation of First Amendment beliefs within the school, mm-hmm. that it is a forum for student voice and that it is not subject to staff review. That's a very controversial issue in a lot of high schools. And yet what I know has happened at Greendale, as has happened in our First Amendment schools, is that when you move to a student publication being produced without faculty review or without principal approval, what has to happen before that is a real grounding in journalistic ethics. You help young people learn how to make appropriate choices and what the standards are, and then give them opportunities to exercise those freedoms in a safe and protected environment.
Mm-hmm. So as you look at your involvement in this project over the last 7 years, and you combine that with your own experiences in the past, working for the YMCA in the Cleveland area, working as a teacher, you have a bachelor's degree in psychology and a master's in school counseling. What are a few things that you have taken away from this so far of your experiences that either surprised you about this project or things that just have overwhelmed you in terms of how it's been received by the schools, by the community, or even the organizations that have been involved at the national level?
I think it's not unexpected, but the true joy in this work has been that the kids show you the way. Far too often we underestimate what kids can do. And my own experience in working around mental health issues and kids who are often ostracized is that those kids are least likely to have voice. And yet every single time you give them that opportunity, they step up to the plate. We sometimes put such restrictions around our kids, and we put artificial structures in place in the name of safety or in the name of critical thinking, in the name of organization and control. And when we give young people the opportunities for choice and voice, they come through with better decisions every single time. The other thing I think that's been really critical in this process is remembering that kids are kids. And while we talk about First Amendment schools, and many folks would like to say, oh, well, then you're talking about global issues and the kids are all involved in the election and they're solving the problems of the environment. Sometimes it's about pizza in the cafeteria. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's about clocks in the hallway. Sometimes it's about whether or not the bookmobile goes to certain areas. We can't impose on kids their own reality. They know what the important issues are. And yet those concepts of voice and choice, responsibility and rights, and civic and civil discourse apply just as much to whether or not we should have pizza in the cafeteria on any given day mm-hmm. as they do to the great global problem solving and issues of our time.
Your mission statement of the First Amendment schools, I think really, I mean, what you just stated just succinctly focuses in on the mission statement. And for some reason, organizations have the hardest time, as we both know, in writing mission statements. And I think your mission statement is so focused. And maybe if you could read that for us, because I think it just encapsulates everything that you just said and that we've been talking about.
I assume you're talking about our tagline, that First Amendment schools are educating for freedom and responsibilities. We are a national initiative designed to transform how schools model and teach the rights and responsibilities of citizenship that frame civic life in our democracy.
It's certainly very clear to me that you believe in what you're doing. I mean, this sounds like this is more than just a job for you.
This is a passion.
Yeah, I can tell.
Clearly,
I can tell
a passion.
That's great. We've been talking this morning with Molly McCloskey, Project Director for the First Amendment Schools, and you can go to their website. It's firstamendmentschools.org. It's a wonderful site. There are all kinds of great links to all kinds of other organizations. There are lesson plans. It's just a tremendous amount of information. Molly, thank you so much, and I hope we can have you on Education Matters once again.
Steve, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And now segment two of Education Matters. My guest is Dr. Matthew Ladner, and he is with the Goldwater Institute in Phoenix, Arizona. Former Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, Louis Brandeis, said, "It is one of the happy incidents of the federal system that a single courageous state may, if its citizens choose, serve as a laboratory and try novel and social economic experiments without risk to the rest of the country." And that's actually from a 1932 court case, New State Ice Company versus Liebman. I'm very pleased today to have as my guest here on Education Matters Dr. Matthew Ladner, who's vice president of research for the Goldwater Institute in Phoenix. Prior to joining the Institute, he was director of state projects at the Alliance for School Choice. He received his PhD and master's in political science from the University of Houston, and also his undergraduate degree from the University of Texas at Austin. Matthew, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Before we talk about school reform, in particular, the kind of reform that is taking place in Florida and how that might be extrapolated into other states, whether it be Arizona or even here in Wisconsin, maybe if you could just talk briefly about the Goldwater Institute and what its goals are and also the mission.
Sure, I'd be happy to. The Goldwater Institute is a nonprofit think tank, and we are dedicated to preserving the ideals of the late Senator Barry Goldwater, first and foremost of which would be, you know, ordered liberty and limited government.
As you embarked on the project that we're talking about, and you worked with Dan Lipps, who's a senior fellow at the Institute. As I read through the policy report, and the official title of this report is Demography Defeated Florida's K-12 Reforms and Their Lessons for the Nation. I've read the executive summary, and maybe if you could just summarize it in terms of what you found in your research with respect to what's going on in Florida, and then maybe talk about implications at the national level.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Florida implemented a very robust set of education reforms starting in 1999, and the results of these reforms have really been remarkable. Since 1998, using the nation's report card fourth grade reading test, the percentage of fourth graders in Florida statewide who are effectively illiterate, which is crucial. You have to learn how to read in the early grades or it becomes extraordinarily difficult to ever learn to read. So in a lot of ways, early elementary reading is the linchpin of all other learning. The percentage of Florida fourth graders basically scoring illiterate on the national test on reading dropped by 32% between 1998 and 2007. That's a lot of change. And this gain did not come at the expense of higher achieving children. Actually, the percentage of kids scoring at the highest level advanced on the nation's report card actually doubled from 4% of students to 8% of students. And Florida made so much progress on the reading, and I should mention that Florida is a pretty tough nut to crack in terms of education reform. About half the kids in the state are free reduced lunch eligible. About half the students in public schools are ethnic minorities. This is not, you know, Minnesota or New Hampshire we're talking about here. It's also a state that does not spend a large amount per pupil in the public school system. They achieved this remarkable amount of progress, so much so that Florida's Hispanic students in 2007 on the nation's report card reading test, Florida's Hispanic students outscored the statewide averages for all students in 13 different states on fourth grade reading. Okay, their Hispanic students, after a huge amount of progress, were outscoring 13 statewide averages, and their African American students in Florida are now outscoring 2 statewide averages for all students, and they're within a hair's breadth of most of those, other 11. States that Florida's Hispanics outscored. So the really important lesson here is that demography is not destiny. You know, the fact of the matter is that Florida instituted a set of reforms, and the result of which is we've seen incredible improvement across the board, but especially for Hispanic, African-American, and low-income children.
Mm-hmm. Now let's talk specifically about a few the actual reforms that were put into place in Florida, and certainly there are other states that have put various pieces of it. And the first one that you talk about and that was part of the project in Florida, the reform, was finding ways to foster accountability and improvement, which basically gets into establishing higher academic standards.
Well, Florida did something that no other state did with their testing. But first of all, they did some things right, which most states haven't done, not that they're not unique in. They put in a set of academic standards. They have not dummied their test down. State after state around the country have put in these, you know, so-called accountability systems, but then, you know, when the rubber hits the road, they wind up lowering the passing threshold and making it easier for kids to pass. You know, Florida's never done that. They put in a set of academic standards. They did testing, but then uniquely what they did was is to create actual consequences for failure. In Florida, under their system, they, first of all, didn't adopt, you know, one of these kind of vague labels that you see here in Arizona and elsewhere, you know, where it needs improvement or something, you know, or, you know, even vaguer terms. Florida actually grades their schools A through F, okay, based on their scores on the FCAT. Subsequent to that, if you were a public school in Florida that was rated F2 out of any of the previous 4 years, your students actually became eligible for school vouchers. The thinking being, you know, we're going to grade schools, and the ones that are failing, we're actually going to have consequences for. We're not just going to, you know, send in a solutions team or something equally ineffectual. These kids, we're calling these schools failing, and we're giving these kids options to get out, and that really got people's attention in a big way.
So I believe in Florida, if a school received these failing grades over two consecutive years, then the parents, if they choose, could opt for vouchers.
Yes.
One of the reforms in Florida was ending social promotion, and that gets into a pretty, in some people's minds, somewhat controversial, in that if you hold students back a year, that they're in classes with kids who are younger than they are. People always look at the impact psychologically on the students, but in reading the report and looking at all the data, it appears as if this was one of the significant contributors to the increase in the achievement scores.
Absolutely. I mean, you have to do, if you're serious about education reform, you have to send very clear signals to people that you are serious. And what Florida did on this score makes so much more sense than what a lot of states have done. A lot of states have tried to use their state test as a graduation exam. Right, you have to take this exam when you're in 10th grade, and you have to pass it, or we're theoretically not going to give you a diploma. In actual practice, that gets watered down. It doesn't actually happen, but the most important point is that is a problem, trying to address a problem on the back end. How many first, second, third graders do you know that are sitting around wondering or worrying about whether or not they can pass a test in 10th grade?
Mm-hmm.
The reading research shows very clearly that you have absolutely got to learn how to read while you're young. We are neurologically wired to learn languages at a young age. And what happens to kids that don't get their basic literacy skills down in the early grades in elementary school is they literally fall further and further and further behind grade level with each passing grade. They drift into middle school. They can't read the textbooks in front of them. How can you learn about science or math or anything if you can't read, right? And, you know, these kids never envision themselves going to college. They start to wonder what they're doing there, and they start dropping out in large numbers starting in the eighth grade, okay? And that is an all too common story in this country. Well, what Florida did was to put a stop to this at third grade. They basically said, look, if you can't read, do third grade level reading at the end of the third grade, right, if you're far behind that, we're going to require you to take the third grade again. Now, there are some exceptions for children with ELL and disabilities and whatnot, but what this has done is to provide, you know, I mean, a clear signal to not only to schools but also to parents, right, that this is very important, and it's something that needs to be, you know, a big focus of what the efforts are. So, you know, the research, there's been formal research done on this, and the kids that are actually held back actually wind up surpassing kids that scored just over the threshold on their score. Mm-hmm. So they wind up, you know, not only catching up, but actually getting ahead.
As you looked at all the data, what impact do you see the compensation, the hiring policies, alternative certification, merit pay, and things related to those areas? How do you see those impacting on the academic achievement of the students?
It's very interesting. In Florida, half of all new teachers are now coming through alternative certification routes. And I have not seen, you know, a formal evaluation of, you know, of test scores and that, but it's fairly safe to say that when your scores are going up as strongly as Florida's, it definitely didn't hurt, and it very well may have helped. On merit pay, Florida put in a really very interesting program in 1999 called One Florida, and the basic idea of it was to couple an improvement in instruction in high schools, you know, focused on minority students, with the elimination of race-based affirmative action for admissions. And one of the things this program did, it was multifaceted, but one of the things it did was to create a financial incentive for schools and for teachers to have kids pass an advanced placement exam. And they put it into the funding formula. The money goes directly to the school. It's $700 per kid passing an AP, one or more AP exams. The teacher involved can actually get $50 of that money, up to a maximum of $2,000 as a bonus. And what we've seen is that since 1999, the number of Hispanic and African American students passing an AP exam in Florida has tripled. It tripled for Hispanics, and it more than tripled for Hispanics, and it more than tripled for African Americans. So, you know, the big message here is that incentives really do work, and the key to education reform is aligning the incentives for the adults in the system along with the needs of the kids. Mm-hmm. And I would say that Florida has only taken the first, you know, steps towards that. What they proposed and what they implemented in 1999 seemed awfully radical. But today, the question is not, boy, why did they do so much? The question is, wow, it works so well, why don't we do more?
I really appreciate you taking your time to talk about the reform taking place in Florida. But what our listeners can do in terms of talking to their legislators here and starting with their own school districts and with the state. Please keep us informed of ongoing studies that you do in the area of education and the fine work that you do at the Goldwater Institute in Phoenix.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate your times. I'd like to thank my two guests today, Molly McCloskey with the First Amendment Schools Project, and in segment two, Dr. Matthew Ladner with the Goldwater Institute in Phoenix. For Education Matters, here on WGTD-HD, I'm your host today, Steve Brown. Thank you so much for listening.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard Saturday mornings at 10:30 here on WGTD. Archive programs are available on our website at WGTD.org.
I'm Gregory Berg. And coming up on Monday's morning show here on WGTD, we will be previewing for you an extraordinary film, which is airing Monday night and Tuesday night on PBS in the series American Experience, Taken Hostage, an examination of the Iranian hostage crisis and the events which precipitated it. I'll speak with Robert Stone, director, producer, and writer of this amazing film on Monday's morning show, beginning just after 8.
Well, this week on WGTD's Noon Tunes, we're enjoying the music of Kenosha's Lance Laybourne, recording under the name Baker Lou Line.
See the curtains hanging in the window in the evening on a Friday night.
At the end of every WGTD midday newscast, we feature a song by a local artist. So come on and join us for Noon Tunes Monday through Friday 1220 p.m. here on WGTD HD.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Gateway is taking nominations for its 2023 Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Humanitarian Award, an annual college effort to honor those who work to support the community and exemplify